But since that's not what I'm going to talk about, although Aharonoth does come into the talk, could you turn it down a little bit more, please? He has a microphone on me, but I don't think I need it. But he wants it for the talk. Can you still hear me back there? Good. Now, I'm not really working on the issues of time and quantum mechanics these days. So I was trying to think of, I've been more interested in analogs of black holes, trying to understand black hole evaporation radiation by using condensed matter system, things I call dumb holes. So I was trying to think of what to talk about. And part of what happened was my mind started going over my career and realizing that there were a number of instances in which I have had interests in time, quantum mechanics, clocks, and so forth. And I also realized that at least some of those issues still haven't sunk into people's consciousness, or at least I don't think they have. And so I thought I would go through and review a few of the areas in which I've had some interest in time and clocks and quantum mechanics and talk about those. One of the first occurred, so I've called this a voyage in time. One of the first occurred when I was a graduate student at Princeton. On the general's examinations in the year after mine, they put the famous weighing of energy debate as one of the general's questions. This, of course, was the famous Solvay conference where Bohr and Einstein were at. And Einstein raised the issue with Bohr of delta E, delta T. And he said, let's imagine I have a box full of photons. And in that box, I've got a clock, which opens a shutter and lets out a photon. This box is on a spring balance, so I can weigh the box before and afterwards with as much accuracy as I want and determine exactly how much energy was emitted by that photon. In addition, I stick inside this box an arbitrarily good clock, and at a certain instant of time, that clock opens a shutter and lets out a photon. So with arbitrarily high accuracy, I also know when that photon was emitted. Therefore, I violated delta E, delta T. And this, of course, really bothered Bohr. And he spent the whole night tossing and turning, getting no sleep. And finally, the next day, he came back and he says, ah, but there's a problem. You have this theory called general relativity, which describes gravity. And in this theory, clocks at different places in a gravitational field alter their rates. So when you're weighing this box, the clock inside the box, its rate alters. And in fact, the time when the shutter opens is made uncertain precisely by the fact of your having weighed the energy inside the box. This, of course, was a rather devastating reply. Two things. I thought this was an incredibly unfair question to put on a general's. It took Bohr a whole night of sleeplessness to try and figure out the answer. So if you happen to have seen it, then the problem was quite easy. If you happen never to have seen it, it was a hopeless problem to solve in a general's. But there was something else that was wrong with it for me. And that was that it seemed to imply that the only way in which quantum mechanics could be made consistent was if general relativity was right. Now, of course, if that was true, that would be an incredible advance. I mean, it would show that quantum mechanics implied general relativity. But that just didn't seem right to me. I just didn't believe it. And so when Jeff Opat an Australian physicist who unfortunately died just after he retired, was spending some time at, I was spending some time in Australia with him, and we realized that in fact it's much more general than that, that the assumption that energy has weight basically means that you've got some, we don't have laser pointers here, RIM hasn't heard of this new technology yet. That there's a coupling, there has to be some coupling between the height of the box and the energy inside the box. Now, one of the things that Einstein really did right was that he placed the clock inside the box. Ah, thank you. The red button in the middle. Okay, I'm illuminating by hand. One of the things is that you have, in order to say that the energy has weight, you have to have something in the Hamiltonian which couples the height of the box with the energy inside the box. Because the clock is inside the box, well, what's a clock? A clock is something which has a dynamical variable, t, such that, at least within the state that you're interested in, it's approximately true that dt by dt, t here being the time and t being the pointer on the clock, has to be equal to 1. In other words, if some dynamic variable of the box, of the clock, such that this relationship is true, at least in the particular state that you're interested in. As we've already heard, it's impossible to do that in general. In other words, you cannot find a variable, at least as long as the Hamiltonian is bounded from below, such that this is true as an exact equation of motion, i.e. such that the t commuted with h is equal to 1 for all states. So this should actually be with reference to some state that the box is in. Now we put this into, we weigh this thing, in other words, we have this coupling, and we find now that the rate of the clock inside the box also has this term proportional to z. In other words, the time ticked off by the clock in the box suffers the redshift just as it would in a gravitational field. Bohr's argument was correct in that all he had to assume, he didn't, he of course used the psychologically devastating argument that it was Einstein's own theory, and of course Einstein's own theory is a theory in which energy has weight. He spent a huge amount of his effort and time to make sure that that was true. There was a much more straightforward theory that Nordstrom had developed 3 years before Einstein, where energy didn't have weight, and Einstein rejected it precisely for that reason, that any system in which energy has weight, the clocks will suffer a redshift. And Bohr's argument goes through. But another consequence of this is precisely that so we get that we can go through Bohr's argument and find that delta E delta T is greater than or equal to H bar. Notice I said one of the things that Einstein did right was that he had an internal clock. One could also imagine that one had an external clock. In other words, some clock tied to the laboratory which opened and shut the shutter. One can therefore see from this analysis that in fact there exists no delta E delta T greater than H bar if that clock is an external clock. The delta E delta T, the energy time uncertainty relationship, doesn't exist if that time is an external time. In other words, I can actually measure the energy of a system in an arbitrarily short time with arbitrary accuracy. Now, since many people still are under the impression that that's not true, that's one of the reasons why I went through this little argument. This was, of course, recognized many years before me by Aharonov and Bohm, but despite the fact that they wrote that paper in the 50s, was it, or the 40s? 50s? The community never absorbed it because they found it so hard to believe. Another thing that came in here is that clocks are important. Time is something that you measure. Time is something that is not simply given to you. And so when one talks about time, for example, Jonathan Oppenheim and I did some work, and various other people did work, on asking when does a particle arrive at a certain position. And in order to look at that problem, you have to stick in clocks. Those clocks have to interact with the system. And what you find is that not only do you get a delta E delta T for the clock, in other words, the clock has to have an uncertainty in energy, but for that particle to trigger the clock, you also get an uncertainty between the energy of the clock, you get a relation between the energy of the particle and the time, the accuracy with which you can measure the time, which looks something like delta T times the energy of the particle greater than or equal to h bar. This comes about because in that coupling between the clock and the system, the particle has to have enough energy to switch on or switch off the clock that's measuring whether or not the particle has arrived at a certain position. Similarly, in measuring things like barrier penetration, you also need clocks and have to ask the question in the presence of clocks. Well, another issue that I came to be interested in was the whole, this is a different question, was the whole issue of initial conditions. In classical physics, we know that we have the dynamic equations which relate what happens at one time to what correlates what happens at one time to what happens at another time. So, you know, Newton's equations, dx by, well, there's Newton's equations, tell us what the correlation is between the particle at one instant in time and the particle at another instant in time, given the physical situation that you're in, namely given the forces acting on that particle. But these are just algebraic relationships. They say nothing whatsoever about the world we're in until we specify them, until we actually stick numbers in for those algebraic relationships. And to do that, we have to specify the initial conditions. In these equations, that's x and the time derivative at x at some time. And furthermore, these conditions, although we almost always call them initial conditions, aren't. They're simply conditions. Because using the dynamics, since it's a deterministic dynamics, one can always map any conditions at any time onto the initial conditions. So given any conditions at any time, we can use the equations of motion to ask what were the initial conditions that would have produced those conditions, and then replace those conditions by initial conditions. So we can also specify final conditions with absolutely no difficulty within classical physics. However, quantum mechanics is different, as we've already heard from Lev. Oh, wait. This, however, can be problematic even in general relativity. Well, in fact, especially in general relativity. Because it's no longer true that any conditions can be mapped onto initial conditions at some fixed time. And the problem is that whole problem of singularities. If we take, for example, the cosmological equations of motion with dust, where rho is the density at is some constant, and the density of the matter goes as this expression here. This is supposed to be a at some time divided by a cubed. And let's set the conditions of these equations such that alpha equals 1, rho naught equals either 1 or 2, a equals 1, at time t equals 1, and try to map them back onto the initial conditions at t equals minus 1. Well, this equation is easy enough even for me to solve, and I hope I've done it correctly. That's not guaranteed. And we find that if we stick in the condition that rho equals 1 and ask what it must have been at t equals minus 1, we get that a had to be 0. If we plug in rho equals 2, we find we get nothing. Time didn't exist at t equals minus 1 if rho equals 2 now. So general relativity, the relationship between the initial conditions and general relativity, is a far more difficult relationship. And this, in fact, applies for many of the arguments that people, for example, do in inflation, where they talk about the situation now and cast everything back onto what were reasonable initial conditions way, way back when in the life of the universe. And the problem is that if we assume certain conditions now, those reasonable conditions in the past might have been reasonable at some certain time, but other conditions now, the universe didn't even exist at those that same time in the past to which you cast those initial conditions. So general relativity has problems with this initial conditions. It still, of course, has this relationship that the equations tell you what happens now is because of what happened in the past. The trouble is you don't have an arbitrary past anymore as you do in most other places. So all times are not equivalent in general relativity for your initial conditions. Well, as we've heard, quantum mechanics is even weirder. Because even if we have an infinite amount of time, conditions are not equivalent to initial conditions. So the little example I came up with, and then discovered once again that Aharonov, Bergman, and Leibovitz had come up with this 20 years before, the price of doing physics, almost everything gets rediscovered. And you think you've discovered something wonderful. That's happened to me with a variable cosmological constant. Getting rid of, I did some work and looking at time and quantum gravity where I wanted to get rid of one of Einstein's constraint equations, namely the one that basically determined the cosmological constant, and thought I had this wonderful discovery, only to find out that Einstein in 1919 had already come up with exactly the same equations. Anyway, quantum mechanics. Let's look at a little problem. At 9 a.m., I've got my favorite little electron in my lab, and I measured its spin Sx to be equal to 1/2. And at 11 o'clock, I go back into my lab, and I measure that same favorite electron, and I measure it, find its spin Sy to be 1/2. And my graduate student comes in and says, oh, I snuck into your lab at 10 o'clock, and I measured the spin in some angle. Tell me, what probabilities should I have expected for that result at 10 o'clock? Well, I sit down with quantum mechanics and calculate, and it's a very straightforward calculation. And you look at the probability function, and it looks something like this. Obviously, the probability of her measuring the spin Sx at theta equals 0 has to be equal to 1 because that's what I measured at 9 o'clock. And equally obviously, the chance, the probability of her having measured sy equals a half is also 1, because that's what I measured at 11 o'clock. And if she measured sy at 10 and I measured sy at 11, and I know what the sy at 11 is, then she has to have gotten the same at 10. I'm, of course, assuming that the Hamiltonian of the system is just 0. So the probability function looks like this. This is, of course, measuring minus sx, and this is measuring minus sy. And so the probability that they're equal to a half is 0. But it's equally clear that there exists absolutely no initial conditions. There exists no wave function. There exists no density matrix, which gives me this answer. So this shows us that initial conditions and final conditions are not the same in quantum mechanics as they are in classical physics. Lev already told us a little bit about this little example. Let's say instead of at 9 o'clock, instead of having a spin 1/2 system, I have a spin 25 system, and I measure its spin to be sx to be 25 at 9 o'clock, and I measure its spin sy at 11 o'clock to be 25. And the question I now ask is, what's the spin in this 45 degree direction at 10 o'clock? But as Lev mentioned, I'm not going to, in this case, measure it very accurately. If I measure it very accurately such that this width of the initial, I connect this to some measuring apparatus with a variable q as my pointer, and the interaction is simply this p sub q times this 45 degree value of s times a delta of t, then I find that the wave function for the pointer gets translated by exactly the amount s in this 45 degree direction. Now, if the initial state is very narrow, it's supposed to be much narrower than this, what I find for my probability distribution is this series of spikes at 25, 24, 23, etc., falling down just as I would expect. What happens as we make the measuring apparatus broader? In other words, if we do not measure with arbitrary accuracy, our accuracy of the measuring apparatus becomes worse and worse. Under the assumption that this initial state is a Gaussian state, and results change if it's not a Gaussian, as I make this thing wider and wider, what I find are these bumps start to merge, and this whole center of this packet begins to drift out towards the right. So I get fewer bumps, i.e., it looks as though there are fewer possible values of the spin, and the values of the spin become larger and larger, so that once the width of this bump becomes roughly 5, i.e., the square root of 25, I get a single bump concentrated around 35, which is the square root of 2 times 25, roughly. And the width of this packet is such that the probability of getting some number less than 25 is extremely small. So this is Lev's weak measurements, and they produce weird results. I mean, of course, this is exactly what you would expect. If the x component of the spin is 25 and the y component of the spin is 25, then the 45 degree component, of course, must be square root of 2 times 25. Right? Just a triangle with two vectors equal size this way, this one must be the square root of 2. Quantum mechanics, of course, would say that's impossible. So another lesson about time in quantum mechanics is with this whole initial conditions. Conditions are not equivalent to initial conditions. What does it say about something like a wave function for the universe? What it tells us is that that cannot be the right way of thinking about the problem. You might, a la Hartle and Hawking, come up with some condition on the wave function, on something you call the wave function, which means that you don't hit the singularity. In fact, my interpretation of their condition is that the universe must bounce as it comes to a small enough value. In other words, it neither originates from a singularity nor does it fall into the singularity, is what their condition really is. But it doesn't matter. It's some condition on the wave function that produces some wave function. The problem is that we now have done all kinds of measurements on the universe, not least by the fact that we exist. And those measurements are made now. They're not made at the initial conditions, back when the universe came out of its singularity or whatever it did. As a result, if we're trying to describe the universe, in particular the universe in the past, one both has conditions that we set on it now and conditions that we're setting by the theory on the initial singularity. And those are of exactly the kind that we find are not equivalent to setting some initial condition. Instead of the two-wave function procedure that Lev was telling us about yesterday, I, in fact, like the decoherence functional because I feel it's more general and applies in condition when the two-wave function formalism doesn't really work. Let me just review this for you. This was sort of developed, I guess, primarily by Hartle and Gell-Mann. They pushed this on to try and produce a theory of quantum interpretation of quantum mechanics, which I don't think really works. But that doesn't mean to say that their formalism isn't useful. So let's assume we're working in the Heisenberg representation instead of the Schrödinger representation, where the dynamic variables change from time to time. And I'm going to define this projection operator onto for some variable, some dynamic variable q at time ti, the value of that variable q being equal to little q, I'm going to represent by this projection of this p sub q at I. So this I here represents the time. This represents the value of the operator q. That operator q can be different from time to time, but it just becomes notationally hopeless. So any of these q's do not mean that I'm measuring the same operator at all of these different times. These are different operators as well. Then one finds that the probability of getting a certain set of answers, these green q's, at their particular times, given that one has the results of the measurements at other times, these red, purple q's, is given by a function that looks like this. This is the projection operator onto the value that q at time t1 has value little q, 1, et cetera, q sub r, at time t sub r. The operator q sub, capital Q sub r has value little q sub r. And here's the first in this time ordering. This is the first one that we want to know the probability of. And we keep sandwiching it between these projection operators of things that we actually know. And then we run that whole sequence in reverse again. Psi here could be a wave function of the universe, or it could be some also some projection operator, which represents some complete set of observations that we've made. If any of these projection operators are a complete measurement on the system, in other words, the trace of that projection operator is equal to 1, then we can forget about everything that occurs before it, as long as it's not one of these green guys, and then just take the trace instead of taking this expectation value. We have to normalize this by dividing by the sum over all of the possibilities for the probabilities that we're trying to measure. Now, if we only had one of these observations here, and this piece of Q is these two guys were complete measurements, then we would exactly get Lev's two-wave function. We could rewrite this in terms of Lev's two-wave function formalism. If these are not complete measurements, however, I believe that this is more general than the two-wave function formalism. But it's essentially the equivalent thing. So that tells us that, it shows us that, once again, that quantum mechanics must be the situation of initial conditions, or rather setting conditions in quantum mechanics, is a more complicated situation than classically. Whereas in classical mechanics, one can always talk about initial conditions. Well, choosing our time appropriately, one can always talk about initial conditions. That's not quite true in general relativity, but anyway. In quantum mechanics, we just can't do it. The conditions come in a time-ordered fashion. That, of course, causes difficulties when you're not, as in quantum gravity, sure what time is. So that was another lesson that I've drawn. So far, still incomplete lesson. There's a third little idea that I threw out there back in the early 1980s that has sort of just been lying out there as a little lump, but I still think that there's some truth to it. And that is to say that if time is something that you measure with clocks, then we know that those clocks have to have uncertainties in them in making the measurements of time. But what does it mean to make a measurement of time, the time between two events, let's say? What one is really measuring is the time-time component of the metric. There isn't some label out in the universe that one's measuring. One is measuring certain components of the metric between these two labels that one uses to label the two events that one is looking at. So when we talk about an uncertainty in time, what we're really talking about is an uncertainty in the metric. What we're really measuring is an uncertainty in the metric. But that uncertainty in the metric, sorry, that clock that measures the time to a certain uncertainty has to have an uncertainty in the energy. But Einstein tells us that uncertainty in the energy is also related to the metric via the curvature. G mu nu equals T mu nu. So therefore, the uncertainty in the time is related to the uncertainty in the metric. The uncertainty in the energy is related to the uncertainty in the curvature, which implies that there must be some sort of an uncertainty relationship between the metric. Now, this is a coordinate-dependent quantity, and the curvature. I'm using units in which h bar equals g equals c equals 2 pi equals 1. But that this uncertainty is proportional to 1 over the space-time volume over which one is carrying out these measurements. Obviously, and this is measured in Planck units, obviously if the space-time volume is large, as it is for any of the measurements we do, this uncertainty relationship just disappears into, becomes extremely small. It's an unusual uncertainty relationship that I've never been able to figure out a way of actually implementing in some more serious system, except Diossi has suggested that this is related to the work that Roger and he and so forth have done, looking at what I call gravitational decoherence. One over the four volume of the space-time over which one is making the measurements. Measured in Planck units. So let's say that we've got some mass here that runs into the equivalent of a half silver mirror for masses, some maybe gravitational little potential well or something. I'm not sure exactly how to do this. So that this thing, you know, the mass has a 50% probability of traveling through and a 50% probability of being reflected. And so we have these two masses going off in opposite directions. And Roger has argued that these two masses are going to automatically, are going to begin to decohere simply because of their gravitational field. Now, my first reaction to this was that this is simply an example of what I call false decoherence. Let me mention to you what I mean by false decoherence. Let's take a simple problem. I've got a big mass here, a spring, and that's tied to a string. We have waves, transverse waves along the string as I oscillate this mass, and those waves in the string will damp out this mass. To make things nice in the actual calculations, I'm going to assume that the coupling between the string and the mass, instead of being directly proportional to Q, phi here is the vertical displacement of the string. I'm going to assume that the coupling actually goes as phi dot, instead of directly as just the displacement phi of the string. This turns out to make the equation simpler. The equations of motion then can be solved. They look like this for the harmonic oscillator, and they look like this, the solution to the equations for the phi, the transverse oscillation of the string, look like this, where the displacement of the mass comes in directly into the field phi, and phi zero is the initial field coming in from infinity. So that would be the free field. This would be the values for the free field. And this is the influence of the harmonic oscillator on that field. If we plug this back into this equation, one finds a very simple equation for the harmonic oscillator. Namely, it's a damped harmonic oscillator, which is driven by the initial state of the field. Now we take that field, and this epsilon is not necessarily a small quantity. We take this field, and we quantize this whole system. One of the nice things about linear system is quantization is dead simple in the Heisenberg representation. It's exactly the classical equations, where you simply interpret everything in here as operators. Pardon? Thank you. We now want to look at the density matrix for the harmonic oscillator on its own. And we trace out over the field variables. I'm going to assume that the field is in its ground state. So the temperature of the field coming in is absolute zero. No fluctuations except the quantum vacuum fluctuations in that field. You'd say, well, look, this oscillator is connected to a zero temperature bath. Obviously, its temperature is zero. Well, that's wrong. It turns out that the density matrix for the oscillator looks exactly like a thermal density matrix. The Hamiltonian is not exactly the Hamiltonian of the oscillator. It's shifted by terms proportional to epsilon squared. And similarly, the temperature is something that's proportional to epsilon squared. Now, epsilon, I said, doesn't have to be small. This is not a perturbative expansion. This is an exact thing. So this can be arbitrarily large. And so the harmonic oscillator looks as though it's a high temperature system. Is it? The answer is no. Because what you can do is you can couple another little harmonic oscillator to that oscillator with a very, very weak coupling. So this is the second oscillator is supposed to be a thermometer. And I'm going to look at the state of that thermometer. I'm going to let the coupling between these two be very weak. And I'm going to wait arbitrarily long until the whole system comes into equilibrium. So this is a thermometer that doesn't affect the oscillator much at all. And I now ask, what's the state of this little thermometer? And I find it's absolute zero. So even though the harmonic oscillator looks as though it's decohered, that state, that thermal state for the big harmonic oscillator looks like a decohered state, it's not. Where that reduced density matrix for this harmonic oscillator is coming from is that there are correlations. When epsilon is large, there are correlations between the state of the oscillator and the state of the string just nearby this oscillator. There are correlations which are tied to the oscillator. They're not waves that travel out and damp it, but they're just correlations between the oscillator and the immediate vicinity, the string and its immediate vicinity. When you trace out over the string, of course, you're tracing out over those correlations. And when you trace out over correlations, you get a density matrix. You get decoherence. But as this little thermometer tells us, that decoherence is really a false decoherence. This system is sitting in its ground state, which just happens to have these correlations between the string in the immediate vicinity of the oscillator and the oscillator itself. If we think about an electron microscope, we realize the same kind of thing happens. Electron comes in here, it gets bent by the magnetic field, it has a probability of going this way or of going this way, then it gets focused down again, and we can get a nice interference pattern. But that's weird, because if we trace out only over the electron, that electron has an electromagnetic field, the Coulomb field. And those two Coulomb fields, if those electrons are far apart, don't overlap. And as a result, if you look in the density matrix for the electron, for the overlap between the electron sitting here and the electron sitting here, when you trace out over the electromagnetic field, you get zero, or almost zero. I.e., those two electrons at these two positions are completely, almost completely decohered because of the electromagnetic field. But it's a false decoherence, because that electric Coulomb field is tied to the electron. And when you bring them back again, the overlap grows, and the electrons are perfectly coherent, and you get a nice interference pattern forming. So my first reaction to looking at Roger's stuff was, this is just a matter of false decoherence. Except if you read carefully what he says, you realize that there's an extra little fillip that he sticks in. And that this decoherence isn't really happening because of this non-overlapping of the gravitational fields. Well, in a sense it is. But it's happening because when the masses are in these different positions, they change the flow of time. And as a result, they change the phases. of time around these systems. And that's a situation that's slightly different from these false decoherence situations. And it's something that I'm trying to get a handle on. Roger will be a little bit annoyed because I already said a number of years ago I'm trying to get a handle on it, and I still haven't managed to do it. For example, one of the situations one could have is to have a shell here, and internal to that shell we've got tangential stresses, and one can arrange those tangential stresses in such a way that the shell, for example, collapses under its own gravity. Then you've got some weird behavior of those tangential stresses, such that the shell either has a probability of falling in and then bouncing back out, or of bouncing out and then coming back in. And the question is whether or not you get interference occurring up here in the future through this kind of a double slit shell system. The reason I'm using spherical shells is because the situation he describes has got lots of gravitational radiation in it, potentially. If you move a mass this way or this way, there are these quadrupole moments which will emit radiation, and as soon as you emit radiation, you get decoherence immediately. So that's a nasty situation to analyze. Obviously, if they move slowly enough, they won't emit photons. But all they have are gravitons. All they have to do is emit one single graviton, and they've decohered. And it's really tough to stop them from emitting one single graviton. The nice thing about shells is that spherical symmetric systems don't radiate whatsoever. And so one can do the analysis here, and I wish I had the answer for you, but I don't. However, I do believe that it has consequences. If Roger is right, it has consequences for the so-called black hole information paradox. And let me go through this very quickly because I think I'm running out of time. The black hole information paradox is that you make a black hole out of, let's say, elephants, or another black hole out of television sets. That black hole evaporates and emits radiation, and eventually the whole thing disappears in this burst of radiation. But the question is whether that radiation field that's emitted by the black hole carries within it the information that the black hole was originally made out of elephants versus television sets. Is there somehow in this radiation, and if it is there, it has to be an extremely high order correlations between all of these photons that are emitted. The black hole emits radiation that, at least to first approximation, looks thermal. And thermal has no correlations in it. So these correlations, if they exist, has to exist in these high, very, very high order correlations. In fact, Don Page and Preskill and Hayden have argued that these correlations have to be there, are basically correlations between the radiation that's emitted early on and the radiation that's emitted when about half of the mass of the black hole is evaporated. If those correlations are there, if the black hole evaporation process is unitary, then one should and has to be able to measure it in order to say that it's unitary. One can, of course, have the attitude that my theory tells me it's unitary. Whether I can measure it or not is irrelevant. I pray at the altar of my theory. But I don't think that's physics. And furthermore, if it's unmeasurable, then I think my theory should also tell me that it's unmeasurable. And my suspicion is that it is unmeasurable. Because what would you have to do in order to do an experiment, to do those kinds of interference experiments, to see the correlations between the photons early on and late? Well, one would have to capture the photons, all of the photons, etc., given off by this black hole early on, store them, and then interfere them with the photons that are emitted very late on in the evaporation of the black hole. But in storing them, one has to make sure one preserves the phases. Because if one screws up the phases, you don't get interference. But what's the phase rate like? Well, the mass of a solar mass black hole is about 10 to the 43 Planck, which means that the rate at which the phases are oscillating is of the order of 10 to the minus 43 Planck, which is 10 to the minus 83 hertz, is 10 to the 83 hertz. So one has to make sure that one preserves the phases and that one runs the timing of one's experiment in such a way as to preserve phases at 10 to the 83 hertz. That means that one has to set up a clock whose uncertainty is of the order of 10 to the minus 83 seconds. What's the mass of that clock? A solar mass. And that mass of the clock itself is going to screw up the phases. So that suggests that in trying to set up this kind of an experiment where one actually looks at the phases, where one actually does the interference to see the interference of the radiation from black holes, that the very process of setting up that experiment will destroy one's possibility of doing the experiment. This is obviously an extremely naive argument. It suggests that even if black hole evaporation is unitary, it's completely unmeasured, that unitarity is completely unmeasurable. And my predilection would be that, look, that's simply suggesting that Hawking's original argument is actually right. That if it's unmeasurable, if the so-called unitarity is unmeasurable, then it doesn't exist. And my theory should tell that to me, and the theory did tell it to me, even though all the particle physicists detest the answer that was given. Of course, there's a danger that this, I mean, it's a very naive argument, and naive arguments have the problem that they're often wrong, and this one maybe as well. At this point, I think I better quit. Otherwise, I will start telling you stories about, you know, at my age, I had to walk to school for 10 miles through snowbanks 10 feet high, or how I would have, when I wrote my papers, I didn't have tech. I would have to capture a goose first and grind my own ink. So before you think that I've gone completely senile, I'll quit.
Okay, questions.
I have a comment and question. A comment about this, the coherence functional, which if you have a number of measurements, complete, incomplete, of course it's part of the two-state vector formalism. And I think in your presentation, when you put this psi, it's a little misleading because it was looked like that this is your initial condition, but your conditions are this measurements of the part of the experiment which had been done.
I mentioned that. I mean, I'm just casting this in the usual form where you have an initial wave function. If any of those projection operators are complete projection operators, then that psi completely disappears. It's completely irrelevant, etc. And you get if any of those bracketing projection operators are complete, then you get exactly the two-state formalism.
The original paper had usually complete measurement, but there are papers in Aronov, myself, whatever, dealing with incomplete measurement. But this was not the question. The question is really about your comments about Roger's proposal. So this maybe it's for him and for you, because I understood that he's not thinking about the coherence. In Roger's proposal, we have a collapse of the wave function, which is very different from the coherence.
No.
So if there is the coherence there, or there is no the coherence, it's not.
No. Roger and I had this argument yesterday in the lineup. So all that he gets from his formalism is decoherence. And he does not get from his formalism that the universe has this value or this value. That's something else that you have to stick in. And reducing something down from amplitudes to probabilities, which is what he gets from his formalism, is not the same as actually picking out one or the other of these values. That his formalism, I do not believe, gives you. It does not tell you which one of the values you get. So we have a disagreement as to whether or not this should be called decoherence, but I think it is, in my language, exactly what everybody else would call decoherence, with the proviso that whenever you make a measure, you now have a classical probability distribution, and you pick one of those elements or the other out of that classical probability distribution. And that, which element you pick, certainly doesn't come out of his formalism.
So may Roger comment if there is a collapse there or not?
Take the view there is a collapse, but I guess, I mean, I'm not going to disagree with Bill on this, because I think the important thing is that you have room for collapse. And basically, if you phrase it in terms of decoherence, that gives you room for, you know, one thing rather than another. So I think perhaps I don't want to. My own view is that the arguments from principle of equivalence and so on, which maybe I'll hint at tomorrow, I can't do too much of it, that they just simply provide room for a collapse, in my view, or maybe decoherence. I don't think we should argue about this point here. I think once you've got decoherence of a fundamental nature, which it seems to point to, then this gives you room for one alternative or another. It doesn't tell you what the probabilities are. That's something way beyond anything I can provide.
No, GRW is also a decoherence proposal. They then stick on, yes, it is. All they do is then stick on top of it the statement that one or the other of these things occur. They can't tell you which one occurs. There's nothing in their formalism. No, they do not have an exact mechanism that gives you one or the other. I understand what their purpose is. I'm telling you what they do.
I think the issue is just when you have a theory where there's a probability, it doesn't right. tell you one thing happens or another thing happens. It just says there is a probability.
Right.
And then we don't distinguish between these two.
And that reduction from amplitudes to probabilities is what is usually called decoherence within most of the literature.
I mean, I have a bit of trouble with the word decoherence, but I think maybe that's an argument that probably is should be stressed at this stage.
Just first a brief, Julian Barber, a brief comment. There are actually in Newtonian mechanics situations, singular situations, where things come to an end as well. But my more fundamental question is, what do you actually mean by time? Can you actually give me a precise description of it? Because you were flashing times around in your big decoherence functional. It looked to me suspiciously like a totally invisible Newtonian absolute time, Bill.
Well, it's not time in the sense of duration. It's time in the sense of ordering. So yes, in that decoherence functional, there's definitely an ordering background time. You know, something occurs earlier, something occurs later. There's no particular necessity except in the dynamic equations that produce this Heisenberg evolution as to duration. So, I mean, I think... agreed. And, you know, the hope that Hartle, for example, has is that perhaps you can somehow use this decoherence functional as well in describing situations where you don't even have an ordering time. And that gets much more difficult. I mean, this is just sort of straightforward, ordinary quantum mechanics. And that formula, in fact, gives you the result that you would, you know, anybody here that did a quantum calculation, they would get that answer for those probabilities. That formula would give them the answer for the probabilities given these conditions at the various times. Ordinary quantum mechanics, of course, assumes that there exists this thing called time that gives you an ordering and that even gives you a duration. That's an essential part of the theory. So I'm just assuming that in writing that decoherence function. Whether that can be generalized to something like general relativity, where you don't even quite know what an ordering time is, never mind what a duration means, is still a very open question. And that's one of the things that Hartle is sort of spending his time really trying to nail down. Right, no, but that's a different, I mean, for us here on the Earth, asking about the cosmic microwave background, there is a damn ordering time, okay? That occurred earlier than this, and I'm absolutely positive of that. At some incredibly high order of accuracy, I'm positive that that occurred earlier than where we are. And at that point, I can use the concepts from ordinary quantum mechanics. I don't have the problem as to whether or not that occurred before here or not. So I'm using that kind of a naive expectation to state that there then exists, you know, even if you have a theory which gives you a so-called wave function for the universe, the conditions that we set, even by our existence, if you believe in the anthropic principle, already produce a situation in which no wave function describes what the predictions of quantum mechanics are for the system. And if you are going to generalize it a la Hartle, you are not going to get a wave function. There will not exist anything called a wave function that will give you the probabilities for various events. It'll be somewhat, I mean, you will be able to, you will presumably be able to calculate stuff, but will not be by use of a wave function.
Okay, I'm sorry, I know there are more questions, but in the interest of time, we're gonna have to end it there. Thanks, Bill, again.
Thank you.